the first interview, media interview I gave in 2005. I was halfway through the interview, and that's when I realized I'm being interviewed. I didn't realize it. I was so inexperienced, and I had experience in lobbying and political communication, but I was thrown into this role at EasyJet. I was sitting down with a journalist, having a cup of coffee in the airport cafe, and he was scribbling on his notepad, and after a while I realized, bloody hell, that's going to be in the newspaper tomorrow.
Welcome to the Healthy Brand Podcast, and I'm your host, Howie Chan. Each episode, I'll bring you an insightful and inspiring strategist, leader, and entrepreneur, and cover lessons learned that help you become better at influencing human behavior and build the healthiest brands on the planet. Hey, I believe that if you are one of the few people audacious enough to truly build a brand, you have got to communicate. Because if people don't know you, they can't possibly form any opinion or even have a perception about you. Today, we have Oliver Oust, a master communicator based in Berlin, who will share his best tips and tricks to better influence a favorable reputation about ourselves and the brands we're building. So stay with us. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really excited to welcome Oliver Oust. He is the founder and CEO of EO Ipso Communications, and he's also written a number of books about communications. Well, Unignorable, Message Machine, Speak Like a CEO, Mastering Communications. I'll put all of these into the show notes, but what I'm particularly excited about is when I think about brand, one of the key components is you got to communicate about it, right? So it's no use if you build all the foundation, you have all your identity and everything, and you don't do anything with it, you're not building a brand. So welcome, Oliver. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Howie, for having me.
So let's just jump right in. When people think about communications, what are some of the myths? What are some of the things that people maybe get wrong when they think about the idea of communications?
Oh man, there's so many. I think one of the most prevalent is that communication is a soft skill. Mm. And when you look back, where do these terms come from, right? Soft skill versus hard skill. In fact, they came from the US military. And they distinguished between hard skills and soft skills and said, well, if you touch your weapon, if you touch metal, that's a hard skill. But they found pretty quickly that it is really counterproductive to use these terms because people sort of undervalue the soft skills and even the military. It's very important to have leadership skills, people skills, communication skills. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I don't know why, it is still prevalent in business. And we talk, and it's widely accepted to talk about soft skills and hard skills. And I always, you know, when I see someone say this or LinkedIn posts, say, oh, these are great soft skills to have. Oh, so as well, aren't these hard skills? And I think we should just retire the idea of soft skills versus hard skills. And I think about leadership skills or people skills, and that makes it sound much more relevant. And Alex Hormozi has a different definition. He said these are just hard to measure skills versus those that are very easy to measure, which is also a good distinction. But yeah, that's one of the big myths. It's not a soft skill, very much what people look for in leadership and essentially what leadership is, right? Leadership, communication is operationalized leadership, as Matt Abrams of Stanford said. And, you know, I think he's spot on. Maybe another one is communication is an innate talent. We are either born with it, we are charismatic, we are eloquent, we can command the room, and we just have this God-given talent. And nothing could be further from the truth. I think we all start out as being completely unable to communicate. Then we learn the language, and often we just stop at some point. So, okay, I'm good enough. I can talk. I can communicate. That's enough. And unfortunately, that is not true. I think we could always improve. So it's not an innate talent. It is a set of skills that we can acquire. And if you like, in this conversation, we can dive deep and sort of look at the different skills that form the communication toolbox. And maybe a third one, just to, you know, three is always a great number in communication, the rule of three. We all know since Roman days, we're using this, and it's just how the brain works. But extroverts are better at it. That is another myth. And I'm also working with a lot of CEOs and founders. And yes, there are a lot of extroverts, and they are often good at communicating. There are also a lot of introverts who are fantastic at communicating. And often the introverts are actually more inclined to practice and invest time because they may be a little more nervous about speaking in front of people, and they feel a bit more out of control. So often they become the better communicators. So it's not that extroverts or introverts are good or bad communicators. It's they're people who focus on communication and train the skill, and there are those who don't. And that's the distinction, not your character trait.
I love that so much. Well, when we think about communications, and you know, your newsletter, it's called Speak Like a CEO. What if I'm not a CEO? Like, why should I care about communications?
I think for many reasons. So it is leadership in action. It's operationalized leadership. And when we think about what we do in any position of leadership, it's usually two things. One is the sense-making part, where I look at the world and it's increasingly complex and try to make sense of it. I think this is going on over there, and this is going on over here, and our customers do this sort of thing. And out of the complexity, I try to make sense of the world and what it means for us as a business or me as a person. And then the second part is communication. Namely, the ability to communicate, persuade those different audiences, and those are internal, external, and financial. And I may not be in a position of power yet. I may not be the CEO, may not be a C-level even, but maybe I have the ambition to become a team leader or, you know, to head a department. And for those those positions as well, I need communication skills to persuade, to take people with me on the journey, whether they're in my team, whether they're external, like customers, maybe financial, you know, partners, investors, etc. So for all these reasons, I think it's really, really helpful to do that and to invest a little bit. And also, it's more fun, right? It is just a fun skill to have. If you're able to walk into a room and persuade people and they respond to you and you can read the room, because listening is a key communication skill. So I think it makes us better in business. It makes us better people also all around, with our families, with our friends, if we are good communicators. And I think it opens a lot of doors in our career and our lives.
That is so true. You know, I have two little kids. I'm constantly trying to figure out what's the best way to communicate. You know, what is the intent? And to your point, if anybody has a fantastic idea, but if they cannot communicate that, that idea just goes to waste.
Exactly. And that is partly the reason why 90% of startups fail. I mean, we all know this number, right?
Right.
It's very hard to get a business on the ground. And for a business to succeed, everything has to line up. Yes, you have to have a great product or service, but you also have to be able to persuade investors, customers, top talent to work with you, invest in you, go with you on the journey. And I think it's a shame that 90% of businesses fail. I think it should not be that high. And to me, and this is one of the reasons why I wrote or co-wrote the book Message Machine, which is specifically for startup founders, is that I would like to see more new businesses succeed, because I think we need more innovation. I'd love to see business people in business succeed who are innovators, who create jobs, who create wealth, who have great ideas. But often they're lacking that crucial skill, which is communication. As I said, taking investors, customers, and talent with them on that journey. And there's a lot of what we do is working with these founders and just people with great ideas and help them find the right words. And then we talk about message market fit. So you need to develop your positioning, your messaging, and so on. And when you get it, then we say, okay, cool. Now you have message market fit, which complements product market fit. To succeed, you need both, actually.
Yeah, that's really in line with how I see the world, Oliver. It must be also for how you see, because when we look at startups and it can be so hard to bear and see all these failures, because the products are great, the innovation is fantastic, but then either, you know, they don't create a brand for it or they can't communicate it. Like, oh my God, if you would turn the skill level up, you can actually get it to be successful. And I'm totally on board.
Absolutely. And it's exciting, because often you work on projects where there is no ready-made set of words, because by definition, it's a new frontier. They're developing something new. So we have to find new ways of talking about it. And in your world, healthcare, for instance, I think longevity is very, very exciting. So last year, for instance, we worked on a project, a longevity company here in Europe, and you have to invent new concepts, new names, have to think about how it plays out in different languages in Europe as well, not just in English, where you kind of have terms to go on from America. So that was very exciting. And I think, especially for these new arenas, these frontiers, it's exciting to find the right words.
Oliver, how did you get into comms? Like, how did you find yourself in that world?
So back in the late 90s when I was studying, I think a lot of people at that age are like, I'm not quite sure what to do with my life professionally. Mm. And I read in a book about something called a spin doctor. And I thought, that is so exciting. I want to be a spin doctor. Where are these spin doctors? And I have to add, I was studying for my first degree in a sort of mid-sized town in northern Germany. So nothing huge, nothing exciting. But, you know, I wanted to grow out of that and I wanted to see the world. So I thought, spin doctor sounds exciting. Where are they? And they're in London. Oh, perfect. I love London. I want to go to London. I want to move to London. So I moved to London. And it was the time of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. And it was a lot of hype around their ability to communicate, both personally, but also the machine behind them. So I had the chance to sort of learn from some of the best people in the business and spent a lot of time in London, spent a lot of time in Paris, in Brussels, the European capital, where I learned political communication. So I had the fortune to work in corporate communications, political communications, and many other forms of communication the last 20 odd years. And this is how I got into it. It was just an idea in my mind. I could go to London, get a good degree, like do a master's, and then be a spin doctor. And of course, we don't use that term anymore because it's a bit silly, right?
Help the audience think about the concept. Like, what
back to
is
the 90s.
Yeah, yeah, what is a spin doctor, Oliver? Like, how would you place that idea?
There was a time before social media where most of the communication was through the media. I mean, how did you know what was going on in the world? It was newspapers and TV and radio, right? That was pretty much it. And the spin doctor would spin a story, so it would be beneficial to usually the politician, but also the business, right? And it was just a term used at the time. It didn't last, it didn't age well, but it just shows that it was just an idea I read about in a book. I thought, that sounds so cool.
And it's so interesting, isn't it? It brings to mind some sort of archetype that can manipulate and change or quote unquote spin things into a beautiful form.
Yeah. And it just shows, I think, you grow up and you have the things you know about, the jobs you know about, they're lawyers and doctors and teachers and other things, they're pretty obvious, but there's a whole world of professions you could think about for yourself or create. I mean, today especially, you can create your job, you can invent a profession. And it's so exciting.
It is. So let's dig into it, right? So when you think about communications, and you obviously do a lot of training and helping people to communicate better, what are the pillars? Like, how can people think about the different sets of skills they need to acquire to be better communicators?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first of all, I would distinguish between personal communication skills that we all can all develop and businesses' communication skills, like crisis communications, marketing, and so on.
Right.
So let's maybe stay on the personal communication skills. I would 80-20 this because there's so many, and like everything, you don't need them all. You just need the most important ones. And we singled out in my book, Message Machine, 5 skills I think everyone should have in business. And the first one is communicating with clarity. Clear thinking leads to clear communication. I think maybe you've probably seen this as well, that a lot of communication business is pretty muddled and hard to understand. It suffers from the curse of knowledge in part. You know, we believe that what we know, other people know as well. Or the other problem I see is the sort of, you know, we communicate inside out rather than outside in. So we talk about the things we find interesting, but not necessarily about the things the audience finds interesting. So communicating with clarity, and that requires us to think about the audience, the context, and just find the right words to bring ideas from our head into someone else's head. And that's really what it is all about. And clarity beats complexity anytime. And it's not that the audiences don't understand more complex language. It's just that our brains are not wired to invest the energy to understand something. So if it's not immediately clear, it's not about dumbing down. It's about being clear and being effective as a communicator. So clarity, communicating with clarity, would be number one. Number two is listening. Listening skills are so important. And for some people, it comes more easily. Introverts are maybe a little better at this. Something for me, I need to always remind myself just to listen. And it's not just hearing, right? Hearing is a physical act. You know, sound waves reaching my ear. I'm talking about actually listening to understand where someone's coming from, reading the room, looking at the body language, the facial expressions, all of that. So really to understand what's going on inside someone and picking up all the signals that they are sending me. So listening, very, very important. Number three would be storytelling. And this is also a fantastic subject, and we could talk about this for hours. It's so interesting. But storytelling is actually a key skill in business, because storytelling beats fact-telling any time of the day, any day. Why? Because we as humans are hardwired and interested in stories, and we remember stories. So if I want to communicate facts, I would embed them in a story, and studies show that people will be 20 times more likely to remember it, and probably also you if you're the storyteller rather than the fact teller. And the fourth one I would mention is speaking and presenting with impact. In business, we all speak and present all the time, right? And there's this terrible habit where someone said, okay, there's a 30-minute slot for my presentation. Well, that's 30 PowerPoint slides. And, you know, I can kind of read the slides, so I don't have to prepare that much. I'm paraphrasing, but unfortunately, that's the reality in some companies. I get it. It's partly a time problem, but there's a better way, right? So to present with impact, to speak with impact is something that can be learned and should be learned, I think. And again, we will be much more effective as communicators if we use the right structures, the right cues, and all the things, you know, I teach and coach. We're actually also faster in preparing a presentation, preparing a speech. So for me, it's always, let's get it done faster, but it should also be better. So that's always the dual aim. And the fifth one is difficult conversations and bringing those to positive outcomes. Because if I'm in any sort of leadership position, I will have difficult conversations. In our families, we may have difficult conversations. So it's just hard to go through life without being able to manage difficult conversations. And that means managing myself, my emotional state, but also, you know, bringing together some of these other skills like listening and speaking and so on, speaking with clarity. But difficult conversations are, to me, is a different category that we should try to master. So those are five I would definitely underline: speaking with clarity, listening, storytelling, presenting and speaking with impact, and leading difficult conversations to positive outcomes.
That's amazing. Let's dig into storytelling, because I feel like storytelling, or at least that idea, all those words have been used so much, right? Everybody says, story. It's almost like storytelling can bring back, you know, life of from the dead. But then the problem is, what you still see is a lot of people don't tell stories.
That's right.
Why do you think that is? Like, what is the barrier for people telling more stories, Oliver?
I think they don't know how. And if you don't know how, you don't know where to start. And it maybe sounds a little silly, like childish. I think that those two things, don't know how, but maybe I shouldn't because I'm a serious person. And the how part, I think, is easily addressed. And it is really understanding just some basic structures. And just to give you an example, I can tell a story just by using three steps: my story, our story, the future. So my story, I tell, you know, my personal perspective on something, my personal experience. Then I loop in the audience when I talk about our story, how it all connects us. And then the future is, okay, let's together build this future. So I have three easy steps. I can easily tell an emotionally engaging story. I could probably write it down on a page in a few minutes. And it's very simple. But if you don't know this kind of structure, then of course it's harder because you don't know where to start. And the hero's journey is not always right. I mean, it's just an inflationary use of that particular pattern. But there are easier ones and ones that are a bit more versatile. I also like the Hollywood three actor, which is excite, disturb, assure. Again, three easy steps. So you excite, you talk to someone about the bright future, the exciting things you want to do together in the business. Then, of course, disturb is like, yeah, but, you know, the obstacles are away. There's insecurity. We live in a VUCA world. Maybe we have to work harder towards the goal. Maybe we're not focused. And then you go into assure and said, but I'm convinced that if we do the following things, we will succeed together. So knowing these structures, and you know, I have a few, but if you know, like three, four for that work in different circumstances with different audiences, that's all you need. So the know-how part is relatively easily covered.
Oliver, is there a time, maybe you can share a story with us, is there a time when you were coaching someone that maybe he or she didn't believe in storytelling, and then through the coaching, you know, it was revelational, something special happened. Like, could you share something to that effect?
Yeah, I think it happens a lot that people, maybe they don't believe it, but they have this psychological barrier. And often people then open up and they share quite intimate stories with you. And then you have to decide whether that is actually a good idea to use this in a particular business context, right? So often people have very deep motivations for what they do. And this is often related to, let's say, bereavement, loss, those kinds of stories. It could be related to, you know, something traumatic. So you have to be quite careful or mindful of that. But maybe moving to something more slightly more positive. So working with a founder in the area of software development, but for sustainability. So they're developing a sustainability software that can be used by anyone in the tourism industry, helping them to become greener, cleaner, more sustainable. And that requires a lot of data crunching. If you're a big organization, you have hundreds of hotels, you often don't know what's going on. So it's a good idea to have really powerful software in place. And I teased out of him that it was actually, you know, he grew up in different parts of the world and he was diving. He was always on the beach. He saw beautiful nature. And now in the last few years, he had a loss. Now in the last few years, he had to witness the loss of some of that habitat. And that was a big motivator for him. But he didn't connect these. In his mind, those were two different things. And only because I probed him and kept asking about, like, why do you do this? We could actually tease out the story and then bring it together. So the business narrative and the personal narrative become whole and make so much more sense and so much more compelling, because there are a lot of softwares out there that do something like that, right? So how do you stand out? And it became much more engaging, much more, much more of an opportunity for him to tell a story and explain why they're building what they're building.
Did it make sense initially as you talked to him about it? Did it just make sense intuitively, or did you have to?
Yeah. At some point, the penny dropped, right? It's almost like, ah, yeah, you're right. Like, that's connected. And I totally get it. So one thing is a long time ago. The other thing is the business I'm building. And I think founders are often very rational people, or believe they're rational people. But of course, we all have an emotional side. It's just maybe a little hidden. So that's why I think it's important, because stories are emotional, right? So that's what brings in the emotion in business. And that's what our brain craves. Our brain also craves the intuitive. So that's even older, right? So that's where metaphors come in. That's where first impressions come in. So is that person scary? Is he or she a threat, right? So we assess these things very quickly. And then we go to the emotional part. Can I connect to this person? And that's where the stories help. And then we can move on to the logical part. And often we start with the logical part, but the other person is not willing to receive the logical argument. They're still in this instinctive emotional mindset. Say, can I trust this person? Is he or she a threat, etc.? So there's often a disconnect between sender and recipient.
Oliver, I feel like we're kindred spirits, right? Yes. A lot of what we do, it's also helping our clients sort of transform and go within their journey of becoming somebody different or becoming somebody anew. How did you find that skill? How did you hone that skill? You know, when you think about what you have to do, because you know, like we kind of talked about, not everybody starts off communicating, but also not everybody starts off and become a great coach right at the start. How was your journey like to becoming, you know, a coach and someone that can actually help someone communicate better? What was your journey like?
Yeah, I think it was mostly driven by curiosity. And I'm just very curious about how the world works and how humans interact. And communication is an important part of that equation. But I'm also interested in economics, in business, in politics, in history, in natural sciences. So all of these things that allow me to create an ever more adequate image of how the world works, a working model, let's say. None of us has all the answers, or you know, but just a good working model that gets me excited. And I thought, okay, I understand what's going on below the surface. And professionally, I was, so I graduated in London, sort of spin master and spin doctorate. No, I was
That's right. Dr. Spin here. Dr. Spin. Dr. Oliver.
PhD in spin doctorate. No, had a master in politics. But on the side, I worked, sort of helped out in politics, political campaigning. And it was quite interesting because I was a foreigner, as a German in Britain. I could, I think, get a little more insight because no one saw me as a threat, right? In politics, there are a lot of sharp elbows. But I was just an observer. I was just helping. So people would share a lot and I could observe. And I mean, that was at the time where monitoring included taking scissors in a newspaper, cutting out this relevant articles and scanning them. So that's the hot shit at the time in terms of tech, political communications and tech. Well, it's come a long way. So anyway, I graduate in London. I go to Brussels because I think, you know, that's where the action is. That's where all the smart people are moving. And there was a lot of excitement at the time. So we're talking about 2000,
right?
About the enlargement of the EU. The euro was created, lots of new countries joining, the whole of Eastern European.
It's very exciting times. Yeah.
Super exciting. So a lot of young people like me moved to Brussels wanting to help build this future of Europe. And it was good years, it was exciting years. So I learned a lot. You see a lot. But after a few years, it was a bit too boring for me because it's a bit like Washington, right? So it's interesting for a while, but it's also bureaucratic, it's legislative process you have to work with, which is relatively slow moving. So political communication was fun, but after a few years, I wanted to get back into business and see more action. So I joined a relatively recent airline, so basically a scale-up in the airline business called EasyJet. EasyJet is now one of the biggest airlines in Europe, and I was fortunate enough to be part of the team that helped build it. And obviously, growing and rising through the ranks, I was able to shape the communication, marketing, and branding in many countries. And at the end, I was sort of the communications director reporting to the CEO. It was interesting times, to say the least.
What were some of the most interesting, like, share a story. Like, you know, what was crazy about, I mean, again, back in those days, like you said, startup, but the growth was insane. It was, no budget. It was crazy. Tell us
crazy.
More about that.
I mean, the growth was just crazy because you have to, I mean, it's hardware, right? So every 2 weeks, we've got a new aircraft, deploy it somewhere. And it is, if you make mistakes, people die, right? So the airline business is very tough. And it's tough because the margins are low. It's capital intensive. It's labor intensive. It's highly regulated. It is in the public eye. So any mistake, people will know about. So exciting for communicator, but also very exhausting. I'm telling you, it's like 24/7, 365. It never stops. But anyway, so you remember that volcano, the Eyjafjallajökull volcano in Iceland that erupted in 2010?
So
I was one of the first people to know about it in Europe. So I left work relatively late, went to supermarket, get something for dinner. And our operations, so the head of operations or the person who was running the shift in the operations center, like 10 o'clock at night, was calling me and said, well, a volcano in Iceland erupted. And I thought, I don't care. We're not flying to Iceland. He said, no, you don't understand. By the morning, there will be no planes leaving. Oh shit. So I guess we have to ensure that no one turns up at the airport. Yes, right. Because what you want to do, if there's disruption, you want people to stay at home. You don't want them to get up at 4 a.m., turn up at the airport at 6 a.m., and be really annoyed that their flight got canceled. So that leads to chaos and mayhem. So how do you do that? Through the media. So people listen to the radio when they get up. So, you know, we contacted all the media. Obviously, also direct communication. You do everything you can, but, you know, basically working through the night. And no one believed us. So we're talking to journalists and to, you know, producers. And they're like, so, you know, it seems like a normal evening. And you're telling me there will be no flights in the morning. I don't know. Not going to run that story just because you told me. That seems a little off. But then other airlines chimed in and they said the same thing, British Airways and so on. So it happened. So the word got out and it was crazy because no flight went anywhere for a week. And obviously you're in the middle of it. And the airline, you have to say, the law says we have to pay for everything. You have to put people up in hotels. You have to feed them, even if it's not your fault, right? So it's very costly. So every day you can't fly costs a fortune. And politicians were very hesitant. They were looking for like a no-risk solution. We said, look, there is no risk solution. flying always entails risk. It's the nature of the thing. Life entails risks. But we think the risk is so low that we can justify getting back to normal schedule. And what then, and this is credit to British Airways at the time, Willie Walsh, the then CEO, just had enough. So all his long-haul aircraft descended onto London, and he was basically telling the ministers, you know, from what I've heard, look, do you want us to turn all these people back, or can we lend these aircraft? Of course, these are also voters, and the world was watching, so the minister gave in and said, okay, let's lift the flying ban. Let's go back to flying. And it was completely safe. But that was a very crazy week we all suffered through, basically the unpronounceable Icelandic volcano, and I can still pronounce it, which shows you that it's traumatizing. It's burned into my soul.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's understated is how the readiness that you need to have as a communicator, because you're so tied to current events and what's actually happening in the world. Whereas a lot of times, you know, even in a in a corporate world, you're kind of behind the scenes. Right? You know, you're like, oh, you know, I'm going to wait till 9 to respond or whatever, because those are my hours. Talk to us about that readiness and what you have to be or be prepared for. Mm-hmm. And why do you do it? Like, why is it exciting for you? Do you believe that the best things in life are free? Well, good. I've just released 6 different guides and blueprints that compiles my years of building brands in healthcare. And they've taken me over 100 hours to create. And they are now absolutely free for you to download. You don't even have to enter your email. Just go to healthybrandconsulting.com/free resources. And that's healthybrandconsulting.com/free resources. Enjoy! Now back to our episode.
Yeah, so the readiness is crucial, and aviation, aerospace, that's the state of the art, right? Those people are the best because they, as I said, you know, it's always lives at stake. And you see with Boeing that, you know, it's global news. The share price is in the dumpster if you get one mistake. It's very unforgiving. So you need to be able to respond very, very quickly. And the real game changer was when, you probably remember this, the Hudson River landing. Was it 2010, roughly?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I think it's even a film with Tom Hanks playing the pilot, and it's a whole thing. And that was the first time that citizen reporters basically beat the media, even though it was the middle of New York City, right? So in CNN, everyone was there. And everyone in the industry looked up and said, okay, this game has really, really changed now. Before that, there was even in some airlines crisis manual, they would even whitetail the aircraft. So let's say there was a crash and they would paint white paint over their company logo because they knew the cameras would come. And then their logo would be associated with this crash. And of course, the idea right today that you could do this is completely absurd because everyone would get their phone out. Everyone would report live that you're trying to
hide. There's no hiding.
There's no hiding. It's such a transparent world. And so the readiness is crucial. And obviously in my work, I often bring that kind of readiness to other sectors who could be hit, but maybe haven't had these experiences and are quite in the public eye as much. You know, B2B companies, you know, others who probably have a little more time to respond, but still they're very vulnerable. Because partly cyber attacks and you know, there are many things that happen to all companies. So no one is secure anymore. And also, there are things now with AI, like deep fakes, memes that travel around the globe, auto-translated into any language. I mean, we know about this. And a lot of celebrities have already been the victims of these scams and jokes and whatnot. But for companies, it can be quite dangerous as well. There can be scams, there can be fraud, there can be just crisis triggered by a video of the CEO, but it's a deep fake. So for many reasons, companies are well advised to be really well prepared these days when it comes to responding to a crisis. And you know, it doesn't come natural to many companies because it really means you turn over every stone and say, okay, what are the vulnerabilities here? And also, usually there's something more important any given day. But at the end of the day, you know, it may not be convenient. It may cost some money, but it's nothing compared to a crisis you're not prepared for.
Yeah. You know, I still say that never let a good crisis, you know,
go to waste,
right? Because it's so important. I mean, it's particularly for brand, it's those toughest moments that people judge you on how you show up.
Absolutely.
If you're able to show up really well,
yeah,
it actually brings back reputation to your brand, even though you had a mistake and you screwed up. Because as we all know, we're all people. Organizations are made out of people, and you can't make mistakes. It happens. But how do you show up when times go bad?
Exactly. And ideally, you have some brand equity in the bank with consumers and the public.
That's right. That's right.
So if the crisis is the first thing people ever hear from you, that's a problem. So you want to have, as I said, some brand equity. You want to have the context. You know who to call. You're prepared to manage the social media, which some companies are just not. They just think they can issue statements and that will manage social media. Because what is a crisis? A crisis is there's an evolving narrative. It's a story that happens in front of our eyes. And the question is, who's the villain, right?
Right. So,
and usually the assumption is, oh, the company is the villain because that thing just happened to them.
That's right.
And it is very important to understand these dynamics, the storytelling dynamics behind a crisis. And a lot of companies still think in this sort of very factual, very corporate, very legally driven language when they want to manage a crisis, and that often backfires.
Yeah, no, that's so true. Like many times it's just like, we're going to shut down, not say anything. And then what the problem there is, like you talk about the story, then you don't control the story. Then somebody else is telling your story in which you could have owned and use that as a moment to shape a narrative about what's actually happening.
Yeah. Now,
are there controversial topics in the world of comms today, Oliver? Like, what do you see? Obviously, you are at the forefront of a lot of these, working with a lot of different clients. Like, what do you see as some discussions that are happening today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, and this is still, the jury's still out on this one, but
sure.
I'd say there's sort of purpose versus mission. And this is more important than it sounds. It's not an academic question, but it comes down to the question whether a company or a CEO should take a stand on whatever happens in the world, right? Whether it's Black Lives Matter, Israel-Palestine, the Ukraine war.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an important question, I think. And there may not be one right answer, many wrong answers, certainly. But it's very difficult, and this is something where a lot of corporate communicators in-house think about, okay, how do we manage this? There's this constant demand and expectation that we comment or evaluate things that are happening outside our control, that are not really our business. And what I observe is that companies become more mission-focused and less purpose-focused because they're making a cost-benefit analysis, and they see that I can comment on Israel-Palestine, one side or another, but gosh, you're not going to get it right. And a lot of people will criticize you for it. What do you gain? If I stay quiet, no one's going to think about my position in Israel-Palestine, just as an example. But there are many of these examples out in the world. So companies and CEOs now tend to look a little closer towards, what's my mission? So my mission is what the company is for. Right?
Right.
So what are we working towards? And that can be the higher good. That can be, we want to fight climate change. We're doing this with this software, or we're doing this with this new solar technology. And that is our mission. It could also be that, oh, we want to build the best streaming platform for music in the world and make our customers happy. That's our mission. And whatever you decide, I think it's just important to be open and transparent about it, especially towards your own people. Because in the hiring process, it makes sense to be very clear about who you are as a business. What's your DNA? What do you talk about? What do you not talk about? If you say, this is our mission, I'm not going to, we can't really influence anything else. This is our mission. And if you like that mission, you buy into it, great. We could work together. But if you have other things in mind, maybe it's not a good fit. And then I think over time, people will self-select themselves in or out of certain jobs and companies.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You know, from my perspective, it's really about showing up as who you are and what is truth for you, right? So I feel like there are two different conversations here where there are your employees, and then there's also like what you project outwards. I feel like those usually is the same thing, but what you do can be different. So like, for example, there could be a Palestine, you know, Israeli conflict. Do you have Palestinians or Israelis in your company? Mm-hmm. How do you talk to them? Like, what do you say? You need to say something, but it doesn't mean you need to take a stand outwardly if it's not in the values and the beliefs of your organization. I personally feel that way because I think a lot of employees would want their leadership to say something outwardly, but if it's not the role of the brand to do so, you should not do so because it is not your role.
Exactly.
But you should talk to your employees and support them in whatever way necessary. I mean, that's a different thing, but I think that's my view.
Exactly. So you have to take care of your people, and they may be affected emotionally by things happening in the world because maybe they're from the region or, you know, they have skin in the game. And I think it's important to do that. It doesn't mean to make public statements about whatever's in the news today. So that's something that is more controversial, that's more discussed behind closed doors, but I think it's important for a company to just have clarity on this point. Where do we stand on this?
Well, it comes back to your number one thing, right? When we talked about earlier, clarity. The five tips, the clarity.
Yeah.
And like you said, I think most companies, even you know, people for their personal brands, don't spend the time to try and figure out what is in, what is out. What do you care about? What do you don't? Mm-hmm. Right. And oftentimes you find they just throw everything in a basket. Oh, we're this, we're also this and that. Maybe I pick a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But then the tough thing about values is, right, it's not about during the sunshine and rainbows where you can stand for everything. No, it's in the darkest times, what are you willing to risk to stand for?
Exactly.
That's what it's about.
They're hard choices. Yeah. Exactly.
They're really hard choices that you have to make. Yeah.
And you mentioned personal branding. That, by the way, is another controversial one. And maybe not as political and controversial as the first one, but I think it's worth just diving into
Let's
that.
Do it. Let's do it.
Because
Let's
you,
do
you
it.
And I think about this topic quite a bit, about branding and what it means for people. So personal branding, of course, it makes a lot of sense for creators, for you know businesses that sort of need to attract customers or clients that are centered around sort of one thought leader. So a lot of models where makes a lot of sense. I think where it's more controversial is VC-backed companies and also publicly listed companies or large corporations. So VCs don't always want their founders to be so public and so have such a high profile because they want them to focus on the business, and B, they fear that maybe if the founders get too powerful, that sort of reduces our influence on the business. So there's a little bit of that as well. And there's a lot to be said for having a personal brand, especially in a young business that has no name recognition. So the brand is still being built. And we all know how social media works. And it's very hard to get traction for a company brand on social media. Whereas if you're an interesting CEO, it's way easier. Now, so there's a lot to be said. And as long as in the service of the business, I'm all in favor. I think the CEO is a strong asset for any company if they're interesting and have an interesting story to tell, which almost all of them have. But they can also get high on their own supply, right? So they can leave, they can lose some of their focus. They're not the Kardashians, right? So there's too much of a good thing here. So if they get high on their own supply, if they spend too much time on Insta, on Twitter, if they get distracted, if maybe the business isn't going well, but they are too focused on social or being out, speaking at events, networking, etc., you know, that can lead to friction with investors, with the board, with co-founders, with the team. So I think there's, you know, we're constantly looking for the right balance when it comes to personal branding. And I think even the word triggers a lot of people. So that in itself, and there's probably better one, but you know, it's just the one that's commonly used and people know what it means.
It's very true. Like I've seen folks that talk about personal brand, like why I'm not a brand, like why I'm not a product, you know, so why am I, you know, being branded? Mm-hmm. I think that's for me, these are more, I feel like, academic discussions about lexicon.
Yes.
You know, exactly. And nomenclature, because in the end, it's about what do you want to be known for? How do you want people to view you, perceive you before they come to know you? And I love this discussion about CEOs and what they're doing for their companies. Also, when you say, you know, why do you need to have a personal brand? What is it good for? Then my question is, what is it good for? For whom? Who's good are we trying to to sculpt here, right? Yes. Like, what are we trying to do? Yeah. And like you said, in the case of if it's a CEO that the VC brought in, yeah, the VC does have some control and responsibility and accountability to their shareholders, their investors, right? And so then the good should be on the company. But if it's a founder, you know, you can see this every day, right? Like, for example, Elon Musk, he could give two shits about, you know, what people think about him as a person, you know, his personal brand, but he does it all the time. Yeah. And can we say people are not drawn to his brand because of him? I mean, we can't really say that. He probably built a lot of things based on his personal brand. So I don't know, like, you can't really judge, is it good, is it bad, for whom?
Exactly. And when people wonder about the term, I said, well, think about it as your reputation. Everyone has a reputation. If you take care of it, I call it a personal brand. If you just leave it, then, you know, up to chance, you still have
that
reputation.
Is 100%. I feel like, you know, when I think of a personal brand, you know, to someone that's been laid off, talk to people who have been laid off, like, you never want to be the best kept secret in your company because the company has no loyalty to you, really.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, you are, in fact, I feel like you are a product. You are a service. You are a solution. You know, that's what you are trying to do. You're trying to be valuable to your community, to the society. So you need to have some sort of a reputation so people want to work with you.
Exactly. Yeah. I think the days are over where we could just do a good job and get quiet recognition. For better or worse, it's not the world we live in anymore. It's, you know, do good things and talk about it. But, you know, don't forget about the do good things. That needs to come first.
That's the base.
Some people
that's
skip
the
that
baseline. Right. Oh, yeah. A lot of people skip that step, right? A lot of brands become very hollow, like you see in social media. Like, it's all the flash. It's all the bling. There's no meat on the bone. There's no, like, steak to the sizzle. There's no real tangible thing, right? It's all smoke and mirrors.
That's right.
Which is sad. You know, for me, there has to be some good to it. And again, it's our values, right? It's how we live by it. We can't force people to do what we want them to do anyway, right?
Yeah. That's right.
So, you know, back to, you know, controversy, but also about, like, coaching. Is there something, so I think people in the audience, some of them are probably in the world of communications as well. Maybe they're growing in their careers. Maybe some of them are thinking about, oh, maybe I could be a consultant and a coach too. What are some, maybe you can shed another story of as you were growing to be a consultant, as you were starting your business, maybe there are some failures you can share that you really learned from. And people can feel like, oh man, it's I don't have to be afraid of failing, you know? It's something that I can take on too.
I mean, where to start? Lots of failures, of course. So just professionally, as a communicator, the first media interview I gave in 2005, I was halfway through the interview, and that's when I realized I'm being interviewed. I didn't realize it. I was so inexperienced, and I had experience in lobbying and political communication, but I was thrown into this role at EasyJet. So I fly out to airports, I meet people, call up journalists, hey, do you want to meet for coffee? You know, in the political communications world is you meet for coffee and you build trust and a relationship and you look at people, can we trust each other? Can we trade information? But I was sitting down with a journalist having a cup of coffee in the airport cafe, and he was scribbling on his notepad. And after a while I realized, bloody hell, that's going to be in the newspaper tomorrow. So I better be careful what I say. And, you know, I was thrown in at the deep end. It was fun. And, you know, it appeared in German, so no one at headquarters could understand it, because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't fantastic, obviously. But after that, I was really sharpening up about, okay, anytime you meet a journalist, you know, it's all on the record. You have to be really mindful of that, but come prepared, bring the stories, make sure you get the headlines. So these are skills that develop on the back end of that, you know, failure. That was maybe more embarrassment than a failure, but hey,
it wasn't like a formal thing, like, hey Oliver, I'm gonna ask you a series of questions, is this gonna be an interview? No, you just kind of whipped out the notepad and just started writing.
Hey, let's meet for coffee. Yeah, sure. And you meet for coffee, and then it becomes an interview. And, you know, this is how journalists work. They have to publish a story, they have to file the story that day, they need something, right? And once you understand it, you can use it for your own. You bring a good story, the story you want, and you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's not a machine, it's, you know, it's humans, and obviously they have their own agenda and editorial guidelines. But yeah, that was pretty embarrassing. And as a consultant, well, you know, after I left EasyJet, so it's about 12 years ago, I set up my own business. I went back to Germany. I thought, okay, Berlin is a cool place. Everyone's moving to Berlin. It's getting really international. I'm actually German. I speak the language. I have a passport. So, okay, maybe I can move there too and set up a business and take all the spin doctory I learned in my, you know, whatever it was, 15 years abroad in Brussels and London, take it back home.
Yeah.
Where the communications world wasn't as developed, and built a business around that. And I think, I'm not sure it's a failure, but for years I was sort of looking for the positioning. I was looking for, actually, where do we want to go with this? You know, is it an agency? Is it a consultancy? I wasn't intentional enough about building a business. And until Corona, I thought, you know, I actually had quite a big team. And I also didn't know myself well enough to understand that I don't want a big team. I don't want to build a big agency. I had this idea, I need 100 people and we're massive and we're going to sort of be the, you know, be the shit in town and be awesome. And
king of the castle, Oliver, king of the castle.
Oh, jeez. And over the years, I realized it's not what I enjoy. I don't enjoy managing a big team. You know, I've managed lots of teams, but small teams are great. Big teams are, you know, it's no longer self-managing in a way. You can't just hire some really good, smart people and they are happy to, you know, do what they're supposed to do. And you check in, you talk, you help each other. But it's pretty self-managing, right? Bigger companies need structures and management and middle management and procedures and SOPs and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I realized in the end, it's not what I wanted to do. I want to work with interesting people on interesting projects. And that's what we do now. And this is what I enjoy much more. Also, the sort of content part of the creator part of the business, where I can podcast, I write books, I'm active on LinkedIn, I write a newsletter, all of that, and I sort of speak like a CEO banner. And, you know, that combination that works well for me, and, you know, knowing yourself and being intentional about the business it took a lot of years to get there.
But did it get too big and then you had to shrink? Like, what was that realization
like?
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't huge. We were like a dozen people or so when Corona hit. And, you know, there was some natural attrition. And of course, Corona wasn't great for the business. So we shrank it. We were half a dozen today. Mm. And that's a much better size. And the idea is not to make it big. I mean, of course, you want to grow as a business, but the leverage isn't to have a lot of people. So it's to be smart about everything.
Yeah, no, I love that, because you can never project what you really want. Project out what you really want until you experience it, and then you're like, is it a yay or a nay? Is it a go or a no go?
So you don't know that you don't want what you want, right? So.
That's right. But it's very true. I was talking to a CEO of an agency a few months ago, and she mentioned the same thing. She's like, one of the biggest takeaways for her was be very careful about projecting out what you want or don't want, because sometimes what you think you want, you actually don't.
Yes,
you know, that's right, and you may get it. And same thing for her, like she didn't consciously figure out the plan, and lo and behold, suddenly she's a CEO, and she's like, I never wanted to be a CEO. I never wanted to have a staff of a whole bunch of people. And I am now accountable for all their lives and you know, bringing in the business so that their families can depend on it. It became this thing where it became a burden.
Mm-hmm. Because it reduces personal freedom. And I think for me, the core is always to have freedom. And I'm not saying I have perfect freedom. Of course, I have family, I have obligations. I have, you know, clients. And so it's not that I do whatever I want at any moment in time. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about everything I do is voluntary. Mm-hmm. So if I decide not to work with a client, I don't have to. If I, you know, want to take the business maybe a slightly different direction, I can do so. I can also say, look, I'm staying home or not working this weekend or whatever it is, or I go on a trip. So I have these freedoms. And I think the more infrastructure you have to look after, the less freedom you actually have. So, and this is, I'm not at the end of this journey. I still foresee for myself to have more personal freedom in years to come. But, you know, things are moving in the right direction. That gives me a great deal of contentment.
Yeah, no, I, I, um, I'm totally aligned with you. Where can people best find you, Oliver? Because, you know, you have a bunch of books. Where can people find you?
I would direct people to LinkedIn. Oliver Aust, that's A-U-S-T. And certainly, please do sign up to the newsletter. So you find the links there. It's called Speak Like a CEO. And everything sort of I highlight there, every podcast episode, book recommendations, and of course, communications insights. As you just said, you know, the 7 deadly sins of speaking, or 10 ways to stop people from interrupting you. So all of these fun things I find out and then share with the world. So
I
LinkedIn, and then please sign up to the newsletter. It's I think it adds a lot of value. It's completely for free.
Guys, I sign up for the newsletter and I love it. So you guys should definitely check it out. Before I let you go, I have 3 questions at the end, almost like a quick fire round. Mm-hmm. The first one is, I'm a strategist, so I'm always looking for insights. Mm-hmm. If you think about your life journey, maybe this is the period of the spin doctor era, but what is an insight you had about your life so far, Oliver, that you really glommed onto and that really changed the trajectory of your career and life?
It's a great question, and I appreciate you allowing me to reflect on that. So I grew up in a fairly small town, and it was pre-internet, so your view of the world was relatively limited, let's say. So you then get to the big city, London, right? And it feels very intimidating. And then I studied a very renowned, you know, well-respected university, and you obviously think, okay, these people are really, really, really smart and, you know, whatever. And there's a German saying that is basically everyone's only cooking with water. And when I came there, and of course you have to work hard and everything, but you see, well, everyone's just cooking with water. They're all human beings. They have their struggles. They have their interests and all the other things I go through. And then the same position. So everyone is just cooking with water. So if you put enough work and effort into something, yeah, you can probably be one of the best. And so this idea that everyone cooks with water, it is what it is. We're all humans. We all have that baseline. It's an idea that stayed with me for many years.
I like that. I like that a lot. I mean, it really lowers the bar. It makes you not put anything on a pedestal and feel like you can never reach or get there.
Yeah, it sort of calms you down. It's like a German version of Buddhism, if there's such a thing. It's like, everyone cooks with water.
If you could turn back time, if you had the ability to time travel back to when you started your career, Oliver, like what would you say to him?
I would say to young Oliver, it's got to be okay. Yeah, relax. I mean, work hard, don't relax too much, of course, but it's going to be okay. And I think now, where we are in our careers, you can connect the dots backwards, as Steve Jobs famously says. Like, yeah, it kind of makes sense. It seems like a professional journey that is very consistent and makes a lot of sense. Of course, when you're in the middle of it or you're living through it, then it's not that consistent and you have all these options and you feel like, oh, you know, I'm looking at all these things laterally. So is it really... Is it really going to be okay, or do I have to make changes? No, it's going to be okay. And looking backward, it will all connect. It will all make sense, even though it may not make sense in the moment.
Last for you, what makes a healthy brand?
Such a great question. And it reminds me of a quote by Phil Rumbold, who's a great marketing, so CMO turned CEO, a great thinker about all things branding and marketing, especially the food sector based in the UK. And he said to me, well, a brand, well, find the organizing idea of your brand and make it matter, right? And there are two aspects to this, the organizing idea. So I think a healthy brand needs an organizing idea. I think it's such a smart way to think about a brand. What is it, right? An organizing idea. And then the other bit is make it matter. So a healthy brand finds ways to make it matter to customers, to the team, to investors, etc. So basically, a healthy brand has a strong organizing idea and has found ways to make it matter and make other people care about the brand. That's for me is a healthy brand.
Oliver, thank you so much. I'm so glad that you jumped on and spent this time with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Howie. I had a blast. That was amazing.
Oliver is a fountain of knowledge and wisdom. I do hope you put into practice some of the tips he shared with us. Well, we can all be better at communications. And especially if you're feeling nervous about speaking, remember this.
you then get to the big city, London, right? And it feels very intimidating. And there's a German saying that is basically everyone's only cooking with water.
Thank you for listening as always. And if you like this episode, give it a 5-star review. In the meantime, go build the healthiest brands, including your personal brand, on the planet. Take care.